This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all the previous episodes can be found in the archives at heritageradionetwork.org. I'm thankful for listeners like you, and I would love it if you would leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. For those of you with kids at home, I've been working on a new podcast here at Heritage Radio Network. Well, not so new. We're up to 27 episodes. Along with my co-host, Hannah Forden, the program manager at HRN, we've created Time for Lunch, a fun, food-focused show for kids. We'd love it if you'd check it out wherever you get your podcasts. I'd also like to remind listeners that Heritage Radio is a nonprofit, and we need your help to stay on the air. If you enjoy this show and listen to the other great podcasts we produce every week, please find your way to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make your gift and become a member today. Today's theme, WTF is going on and what's going to happen next. It can feel like every day there's more and more insane things happening in the world. But then sometimes you just think, what's for lunch? Some people think about lots of things that the rest of us maybe don't spend the time to figure out, like whether or not food memes are real and if they work. Mike Lee is one of those people. He's the co-founder of Alpha Food Labs and the Future Market, where he's working to envision what food retail might look like in 10, 15, or even 20 years. Mike and I spoke last week about a whole variety of things. Social media, losing your sense of taste when you have the coronavirus, cooking at home, being a new dad, and more. It was a fun conversation, and it was great to catch up with Mike on the phone, and I look forward to seeing him in person when it's again safe to do so.
This is Mike Lee, co-founder, co-CEO of Alpha Food Labs. We're an innovation company for food. We're extremely mission-driven, trying to help companies of all shapes and sizes do better for people and planet. Also founded a project called The Future Market, where we kind of do futures thinking and scenario planning to think about where the future of food might head in the next 5 to 25 years.
Awesome. And that, of course, is one of the reasons why I invited you on the show today, because if, you know, so many things have changed because of the coronavirus pandemic, and food is a really, really, really big one. So I would love to, you know, to touch on a number of subjects related to that. First of all, I mean, you know, yesterday's big news was the DoorDash IPO.
Yeah.
And, you know, an insane evaluation for a company that, you know, on the one hand, and what many people may see as a benefit, you know, makes it really easy to order food to your home, and you don't have to go out and go to the grocery store. You don't have to go to the restaurant. So, like, you know, sure, in a pandemic, that seems like a great thing. On the other side of the coin, restaurant owners feel like DoorDash takes a ton of money and doesn't pay the delivery people very well and is basically making money off the backs of small business.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, right? I think the biggest thing that I saw, I think that transcends not, I think it seems this example, but a lot of examples in food is that, you know, to the degree that, like, I think everyone kind of sits on the spectrum of being more or less mindful about the social impact of the food choices you make, right? You've got one poll where everyone considers every single thing they do, and they're very socially mindful about all of their food choices. On the other poll, you've got people that are like, what social impact? And then there's everything in between. Yep. There's this huge bell curve in between. What happened was, I think that in a time of something like COVID, where literally life and death and just fear sunk in, everyone slid down one or two rungs of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Mm. And I think so, like, you know, if you were kind of like on the, you know, early edge crust of like being super mindful about your food choices, and you try to buy local when you can, and you try to, you know, do good things that are good for the good food movement, I think a certain percentage of those people, when presented with fear, they kind of said, nope, I just gotta like hunker down and keep me and my family safe. So, sure. you know, you saw this in California, right? They banned plastic bags for a little while before COVID. And then once COVID hit, they were like, just kidding, let's cancel that for a second. You know, and I think that to me was sort of a metaphor for, I think, about how a lot of people thought they shifted. It's not to say that they don't care about social issues related to food and the impact of that, But I would argue that most people, when push comes to shove, are going to naturally prioritize their own health and well-being over a broader social good, which is maybe a little bit more amorphous, especially in a time like pandemic. And that's a hard thing to do because you don't want to paint those people as like bad people. Right. It's more complex than that. I think they're just like, yeah, you know what? Like, I know DoorDash is like kind of gouging a lot of these restaurants, but I have two young kids and I can't afford to get sick. So I can't afford to go out to grab my food from down the street. You know, right. I think that's a hard choice a lot of people made. You know, as far as DoorDash goes for that insane valuation, I mean, they obviously benefited really well. And honestly, it's partly them and how they set up the system and them realizing that they leveraged up so hard that they kind of became this quote unquote necessary evil for a lot of restaurants. But it's also just a bigger issue of like the system is set up to reward those kinds of efficiencies, you know?
Sure.
It's a lot there, but it is a really just jarring thing to see that insane valuation and the number of millionaires you're going to mint after the IPO happens. Yet there's still like so many restaurants going out of business and so many people just not even getting any food, you know? Right. So, but yeah, you know, this is a reoccurring trend in America. Honestly.
Of course. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I mean, so, you know, let's talk a little bit about cooking at home, right? Cooking at mm-hmm. home is something that you and I have obviously connected on, you know, in the past, and you've mm-hmm. been on Heritage Radio and talked about your other work, and cooking mm-hmm. at home is something that I've promoted for many, many years, but it's something that has exploded during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think you see people are cooking at home, you know, like exponentially more than they did a year ago. And
yeah.
I wonder if you think that there's an opportunity there once we're sort of out the other side of the pandemic to a certain extent to turn these people who maybe didn't care about what kind of flour they were using or what kind of beans
yeah.
they were using into the kind of people that, you know, sure, right now they might be ordering it through Fresh Direct or they might be ordering it from Amazon, Whole Foods, you know, delivered. But is, you know, is there opportunity there to for those people to be then touched by the educational side of things to say, oh, wait a minute, maybe this beef that I'm buying isn't really doing the best?
Totally. I think a lot of that stuff I said before for a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of people are still just, you know, covering everything in plastic and ordering DoorDash 7 days a week. But I think a big percentage of people, that was sort of an initial Twitch reaction of like the holy shit COVID, like,
right.
you know,
yeah.
But I think like, as you slowly got out of that, there were, I mean, you saw flour companies running out of flour because, you know, sourdough became the trending topic. And that's a great thing, you know, honestly, because I've always believed that home cooking not only has the obvious benefits of feeding your family, but it starts to build a certain connoisseurship in your mind about the ingredients you're using. Because I always tell people, like, just try to cook anything. I don't care if you use like crappy boxed pasta from a private label and like jarred sauce. If you keep doing that day after day, you're eventually going to start saying like, what if I upgraded my pasta?
Yep.
What if I upgraded my flour? Hey, why is this flour better than that flour? And then like all of a sudden, you know, you're not going to find yourself standing in a wheat field trying to look at protein levels and falling numbers of flour if you don't just start cooking something, right? Like,
yep.
I always say like, why, if you don't paint, why would you have any opinion on what kind of oil paints to buy?
Sure.
Right. So,
yeah.
So I do think that that is the great silver lining of COVID. Like after we got through the initial shock and awe phase, people started to dig in and people started to acquire skills. So like wherever you rated your cooking skills on 1 to 10, I think everybody did a +1, you know, so
right.
A lot of people went from 0 to 1, a lot of people from 9 to 10.
Sure.
And that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I wonder if we're going to see, you know, it'll be very interesting to look at like health trends,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I don't mean, you know, just necessarily like metrics like, you know, average weight and things like that. But, you know, there is so much evidence that cooking at home more than eating out is more healthy because the
yep.
food tends to have much less salt, has, you know, often a lot less preservatives. And so I'm interested to see kind of, it'd be very interesting to see in the next like 10 to 15 years, whether or not that does have an effect on things like heart disease. in our generation.
I can't wait for the 20-year longitudinal study of like the knock-on effects of COVID, from the cooking to like what's happening to our children and all the disruptions right now.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
But yeah, I totally agree. Years ago, I think, you know, Michael Pollan wrote this op-ed in the New York Times that I loved. He says, I have a new diet for America. You can eat anything you want. You can eat as much of it as you want. You just have to cook it all from scratch.
Right.
And like having done a giant Argentinian like style meat fest this Sunday, and just the amount of work, which was enjoyable, I'm not gonna do that every day, you know. So
yeah,
it's like, you ever made fried chicken from scratch? It's a lot. You're probably not gonna do it every single day.
Right
So yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I'm one of those people who started baking sourdough. I mean, I've had sourdough starters many times over the years, and I've spoken about it in the last couple of episodes of this podcast. But, you know, for whatever reason, I came to the right rhythm personally in my life to be making sourdough right now. And it's really awesome. You know, I make one loaf a week, roughly.
That's awesome.
And always have fresh bread around. And it's super cool.
You know, for some that I've talked to, too, I think, like, the pandemic and everything, and, you know, between the pandemic and the election, it was very, for a lot of people, there was this, like, not just fear, but, like, this sense of, like, the world is out of control. Like, I can't control anything. And having something that tangible that you can care and feed and look over and, like, use your hands, it's sort of regaining a little bit of control from your life. And I think that's, like, valuable beyond the cooking skills even, and beyond the sustenance. It's just good for your mental health.
Would you say the same thing now about becoming a dad?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, talking about having something that you have to, like, care for and feed. I mean, you're right in the thick of it. How old is...
Yeah. She's almost 3 months old. She was born on September 17th. Her name's Aria. And, yeah, your world gets really small once you have a kid.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, it was really... a nice kind of insulator effect from all the stuff in the outside world, because it kind of put a little bit of horse blinders on you.
Sure.
You know, like I was still stressed out about the election, but I don't think I was as stressed out had I not had a baby, you know, because I was just like, okay, that was a crazy thing Trump said. Well, hey, I gotta go change this baby right now, so I right. can't really sit here and fume about it, you know.
Yep.
You're like, I'm gonna vote and it is what it is. So yeah, it's been great to and ironically, in a lot of ways, it's scary having a baby during a pandemic. In other ways, it's actually, there's a lot of silver linings. Like, we're back here with my parents in Michigan. So, you know, she's getting daily time with grandparents. They're getting daily time with her. We've just got everybody here on this little, like, Michigan compound. So I don't know if it would have really worked out that way had, like, we not had to all hunker down.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's great. And, you know, it's very interesting, you know, to be, you know, as we already touched on, in 20 years, it'll be so interesting, because your daughter will only probably hear stories about what it was like mm-hmm. when we were all here. My kids are 11 and 7. And so they're going to have like very clear ideas on what things happened during this
they're
time
in
period.
It. Yeah.
So,
super
interesting. So you and I think last spoke actually probably way back in like April or May, and you had the coronavirus, right?
Oh yeah. That was fun.
Early on. I mean, you and a couple of other folks who, you know, who we all know through the food industry, had it. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, like, have you had any ongoing symptoms from it? You know, how, you know, are you seeing any long-term effects?
No, I mean, I feel like very lucky in a sense to, because I got it on my 40th birthday, and so did a bunch of other people at my birthday party.
which was right there. I mean, that was
it was literally
in March.
It was March 12th.
Yeah, right before everything closed down.
It was like, just, I remember going out to breakfast that morning, and it was just, that was like the first day you go out, and it's just kind of eerie, and people were like spraying down the counters a lot, you know, but there was no restrictions, there's no lockdown. And then the weekend happened, and then like I had this trip planned to California, this huge like convention and stuff like that, and everything just got canceled within like 3 hours. So that's where it really shut down. I think I got off easy, you know, because I didn't have the fever, I didn't have to get hospitalized.
Right.
I was just kind of really out of it for like 6 weeks. You know, I got the antibodies afterwards. So I think I got off easy, so to speak.
Yep.
And so I think it's good. But yeah, I haven't had anything since. I mean, I'm not like using the fact that I have antibodies as like this reason to feel invincible. I'm still using doing all the right things, but
you didn't go to Sturgis.
No, yeah, I not this year. Yeah, no, I didn't. I'd rather have them than not, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, it's been wild.
The most striking symptom that I've heard about, and I remember we spoke about this back in the spring, is the loss of taste and smell.
Yeah, I had that for the 6 weeks or so, and things have, like, things slowly kind of came back. I don't know if my smell is, like, fully back. I can still smell pretty well, but, like, things don't seem as vivid as they used to.
Interesting.
So I don't know. That could be a long-term effect, but other than that, like, yeah, everything has been normal. I've taken, like, 4 tests since then that have all come back negative, so it's good. But, yeah, I don't know. Nobody really knows, honestly. Right. Yeah. I can taste everything. So. Right.
Do you remember what the first thing was that you were able to taste again after losing the sense of taste, or did it come back slowly?
Like, I made a butter chicken, and I remember lacing it with so much spice because I had to, for just to cut through, you know?
Right.
I think there was a period in the tail end of my COVID experience where everything had an insane amount of, like, chili pepper in it and fish sauce because I needed to turn up the volume really loud on things because, like, otherwise I couldn't taste it. And I did during it. I had this phase, or probably for a month, where food was absolutely disgusting to me. I don't want to eat anything. Everything was just revolting. And I think all I could manage to stomach was, like, just plain white rice for a little bit. But yeah, that wasn't very fun.
Do you think that had to do with the disconnect between, like, you're looking at a plate of what you know something is supposed to taste like and you couldn't taste it?
No, I think it was more just, like, just very tangibly, like, the flu symptoms, the achiness and the loss of appetite, and just the, I had, like, the nausea, you know? And so it's just, like, I didn't want to, like, deal with food, you know? And I was so just lethargic, too. It was hard to, like, even, like, get up and cook something.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to talk about social media.
Yeah.
You know, as someone who, you know, I have, like, mostly a hate relationship with social media, but of course I, like, look at it. You know, I'm not super active on it. I do find it to be something that, like, I have a hard time, like, putting my brain towards spending a lot of time working on it. But I have to say that, like, you know, I follow you, and I guess, you know, I don't know if it's because you have a baby and you're up in the middle of the night with, like, holding the baby in one hand and your phone in the other, but I feel like for the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks, you have been reposting this incredible run of TikToks and Instagram stories in your own stories that have become something that, honestly, like, I look forward to every morning.
Thank you.
When I get up and I'm having my coffee, I'm like, oh, Mike posted more stories, and I look at it and it runs the gamut from, like, you know, I mean, we're friends, so, like, I see pictures of your daughter and that's super cute.
Yeah.
But the other things that you're reposting, I mean, run the gamut from stuff you're cooking yourself, which is fun to see because I miss cooking with people. You know, but to stuff like, you know, people who are, you know, I'm trying to even think, like, insane kinds of, like, puri and different kinds of bread coming out of India. And there was one this morning of a guy who was, like, I don't know if he was making fish sauce. I imagine it was in Thailand or Malaysia, but he was, like, you know, dismembering fish by, like, basically just, like, squeezing everything out of the fish. Automatic meat slicers and people making these beautiful, intricate dumplings by hand. Where does the stuff come from, and how do you cull it all together?
Well, so you hit the nail on the head about the holding up a baby all night. I was taking the overnight shift for a long time so my partner could kind of heal from a C-section.
Sure.
And so I would take, like, the midnight to, like, 6 a.m. shift with the baby. And, you know, when they're that young, you kind of just, like, feed them and, like, you just kind of rock them and they're falling asleep in your arms. And yeah, I literally just, like, had the other arm and I was like, I need to, like, entertain myself and stay awake. I can't talk to the baby or play with them yet.
Right, and you can't call anybody else because everybody else is asleep.
I can't call anybody else. Yeah, exactly. It's, like, 3 in the morning. So, and I can't, like, make content in the traditional sense because it's pitch black dark. Like, what am I going to do? Like do a monologue? I can't do a podcast with a baby sleeping in my lap, right? So I really just, like, started me just, like, idly flipping through stuff and then just thinking, huh, that's neat. And I was so tired that I really didn't, like, think about it. And I think it was that whole feed has just become, like, my culinary id, or just like my weird mood board, like my fever dream of, like, what I think is just neat or interesting in food. There's no, like, thought to it, premeditated thought. It's literally the litmus test is, like, does that amuse me? Repost and share, maybe amuses somebody else. And I think by now it's sort of, I've trained the algorithm. Like, I think the Instagram algorithm knows what kind of weird shit
that
I
was.
Like.
Yeah. That was my next piece of the yeah. question was like, at this, like, at this point, are you searching or is it coming? Right.
Like, I literally, I don't know, even know how I would like come up with the search terms to search for that.
Right.
I think, you know, the nerds at Instagram have just figured out, like, if you like guys squeezing a fish carcass out of the skin, you're probably going to like this weird meat slicer from Indonesia, right? And so, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like, I look back on them. I, like, always highlight them. Like, people can see them on Instagram at Mike Lee. And I look back on them sometimes, and they still entertain me. And I mean, the one thing that just is like the thread is like, I think most of it is just like various forms of making food all along the spectrum, from like handmade to machine made.
Yep.
I think they're equally fascinating for different reasons.
Yeah.
And so I've always just been fascinated by that. And I don't know, who knows, maybe it'll inspire some weird idea. Well, actually it has, actually. The Argentine thing, a lot of asado videos inspired me to like just do one this past Sunday. So that cool. was great.
Yeah, I mean, I look at them and they've run the gamut from like just laughing, you know, like some of them are like, oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
And then some of them are like, wow, that's, incredible, you know, that somebody can make dumplings so fast. Or I think that you've posted a couple different videos. I believe it's in India where there's one guy kind of like maybe 20 feet away who's rolling out some kind of dough and then just kind of without even looking, like just throws it to the guy who catches it, who's cooking it.
Yeah.
I assume it's like across a restaurant almost, but like the thing, it's one, you know, those kinds of repetitive motion things where it's like, these guys have probably been doing this for years, every single day. The guy just rolls and rolls and flips.
So I was digging closer into that one because I've seen that in a while. And like, I was reading some of the comments on some of these things and basically like, yeah, you're right. Across the restaurant, one guy just has balls of dough and he takes one, he slams it down with his little like stubby roller and rolls it out and then chucks it across the room, like probably 25 feet with his other guys like waiting by the tandoor or whatever to catch it. And it's so precise. And like, he does this thing where he bangs the stubby like roller on the table and it goes like, doot, 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 doot. You hear this whack and people are like, why is he doing that? And he's like, it's a tiny mechanism. It's like a metronome.
Yeah.
And it's his way of signaling to the other guy across the room, like, okay, when I hit it, you know that I'm going to throw it like 2 seconds later.
Right.
And I just thought like, that's so cool. Like, that's so cool that like, they just invented this system to like, you know, mass produce food, so to speak, on that scale. Yeah, I mean, to me, that whole like system of banging on the thing is the same as an engineer trying to make like an automatic meat slicing machine or like the skewer
sure.
machine where you stick in a tenderloin and it turns into 100 skewers
yep.
that are thinly sliced.
Yeah,
that stuff fascinates me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that I think a lot about in looking at them is the different ways people are preparing food.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those things come from necessity and some of them are just because people, it's how they've come to make them. But I mean, I love the, like, you know, the spinning cauldrons for cooking stews that then pour out
mm-hmm.
one end, or the people who are cooking like one egg in a like steel ladle.
Yeah.
Like, I look at that stuff and
those.
I'm like, I could do that. I was like, oh man, next time I make a campfire, like, I'm just going to try some of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
that's legit inspiration. I was like, I'm going to try that. I've never thought of that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, and then I absolutely loved the conversation you had. It was with Ariel Johnson, right? About the cooking the shrimp on the toothpicks and whether or not they're like how much actual energy, how many joules you needed and how much you would get out of the toothpicks to cook the shrimp. And for those of you listening, I want to describe this. If you haven't seen this, it's a video of someone who took maybe like 100 toothpicks. Maybe it's like a 10 by 10, like toothpicks stuck in the sand or something.
No, Ariel estimated it was about 20.
It was about 20. Okay. So Okay. So it's like 20 toothpicks that are stuck on end and then they put a raw shrimp on top and light the toothpicks on fire and use that to cook the shrimp, like one single shrimp.
So I reposted that, and to call it a conversation is generous because it was just the genius of Ariel Johnson that was really just infiltrated my inbox. And she is a amazing food scientist, flavor scientist. She started the fermentation program at NOMA, that's a Freudian slip. And she's just a genius at food, but also just a hilarious and wonderful human being. And she unloads this huge message where she literally breaks down, like, I want to calculate how many toothpicks you need to actually cook one single shrimp. And yeah. She was like, well, shrimp is 70% water content. And, you know, the U18 shrimp weighs this many grams, and the amount of energy and wood, you know, is this the many kilojoules. So you need this many kilojoules, but then open fire is efficiency at like 10%. And oh my gosh, she like went science on it. And I was just like, I was like eating Ari or something like that. And I caught up on it. I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. So it's like, I love, I think I said to her, like, I love real brain power applied to silly things.
Right.
Which that was just awesome.
But so, the anyway, other cool thing about it, too. Yeah, I mean, the other cool thing about that is like, the proof is there that, like, that wasn't fake. Right?
Yeah.
Like, ultimately, what she decided was that, like, yes, mathematically, this works. You can, if you need to cook one shrimp and you have one match and 25 toothpicks, you can do it.
We should team up with Ariel and do like a food meme Mythbusters. Just like find all these weird like food memes and just Mythbusters them out. Like that would be awesome.
I think that would be great.
I love it. So anyway, I think she said that I think her conclusion was like that's not enough toothpicks. Yeah, there you go.
Interesting.
So, I love it.
I mean, but then of course you have to get into the philosophical discussion of like, well, you can eat shrimp raw, so.
That's true. So what is cooking, right?
So, I mean, if all you wanted was a sear on the outside, maybe that's all you wanted with your 20 toothpicks. And maybe
I was going to follow up with her because I think she had this assumption about the water content of the shrimp and like how much energy it takes to raise up the water content. But I don't know if she accounted for the shell, because the shell is kind of a heat shield. So you need like an additional boost, I think, to get through that. But
sure.
Anyway, it just sent me off into this rabbit hole. Yeah. And I think if any of your listeners are still listening as fascinated by this, then like, please help us solve this problem. Let's figure it out.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe we could just have like the world's largest distributed cooking of single shrimps on toothpicks. We could have choose a day and it could be like, you know, toothpick shrimp cooking day.
Yeah.
And everybody can do it and report their results, right? Like ambient air temperature and temperature of the shrimp. I mean, you know, you could go really far down the rabbit hole with this.
We could do like a weird X prize for like useless cooking exercises. I think it's great. Let's do it.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's LARDER meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
So, you know, one of the things, I mean, you spend a lot of your time before the pandemic, and I'm sure even more now, thinking about the future and the future of food and sort of what that could look like, what that might likely look like. And I wanted to talk about what in-person gatherings, you know, are going to look like in the future. And this idea that is one that I keep coming back to lately of having these discussions with people where they're like, I just can't wait for it to go back to normal. And that phrase back to normal really bothers me, because I feel like it's a failure of it's a failure to recognize the way that time and history and life actually works, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you know, it would be like me saying, oh man, I can't wait to get back to when I was 24 and I could be at the bar mm-hmm. till 4 a.m. and then go to work mm-hmm. at 8. I mean, like, that's not mm-hmm. that's not ever going to happen again. I'm not going to be able to stay out at a bar till 4 and go to mm-hmm. work at 8 o'clock down days on end. And that's mm-hmm. okay, because that was a period of time.
Yeah. The future of social gatherings. I mean, the way I think about it is I use a phrase that I've borrowed from the meat world and people that, you know, you and I both know who are growing really great responsible meat. And it's, you know, this saying that, like, they say, well, eat less meat, but better, mm-hmm. you know, don't eat just like a weird Tyson chicken, like in pounds a day, like buy like, you know, a really good, well-raised like heirloom or local chicken and just eat them less and focus on the quality of it and just be more mindful about that. I think the same thing applies for social gatherings. I think social gatherings going forward are going to be socialize less, but better, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, especially like if you're in like a dense urban area like New York City, so many of the go-to places where you would meet up with kind of like second and third degree friends are going to be changed forever. You know, I don't know what it's going to be like if ever we're going to be like at a bar where you're standing four deep at the bar. Like, I don't know. Even if like the law, you know, allows it, like, are people just going to be kind of shell shocked by that, or are they going to realize that, like, you know what, I was standing in that 4D bar before, but then I had like a year of like, you know, lockdown, and like, I now prefer just having a beer in my backyard or at a smaller bar with like four of my closest friends, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. Yeah, I think we're all forced to kind of just focus a little bit more. And this goes hand in hand with that kind of leveling up in cooking, right? Because, you know, I think COVID accelerated a lot of the other trends that we already saw, meaning people were, you know, cooking more at home and entertaining more at home. You know, however long you thought that trend was moving, I think it doubled in speed because of COVID.
Yep.
Even like meal kit companies got a shot in the arm, you know, because they were kind of like, you know, I don't know, they were like on the way out, but they weren't as popular as they were.
Yep.
And now it's like, oh yes, give me the meal kits. So.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Is there any food or ingredient that you didn't use a lot of before the pandemic that now is something that has entered your personal sort of canon?
Wow. Food ingredient that I didn't use before. I became way better at bartending.
Nice.
I was like, I've always been pretty adept with food, and I knew what I was doing, even if I didn't know what I was doing. For some reason, like years ago, I decided to study wine a little bit, and by no means am I a wine expert, but I was like, okay, not knowing anything about wine, I can't let this happen anymore. So I learned a bunch about wine, and I know enough to at least just navigate through a wine list in most places. Kind of the art of kind of mixing cocktails. I like to enjoy cocktails, but it just was all Greek to me. And so it's kind of been fun just to like take care of this blind spot in my head. Like, I've been just since the lockdown happened, I was like learning just the foundational like five or six like cocktail formats. And then like I was talking about before, like starting to build like a connoisseurship for different things, like different bitters and vermouths and stuff like that. So you know, while not quote unquote food, I have a new appreciation for that kind of art form. And it really just hit me. And this is so obvious to so many people that have been, you know, bartending for any meaningful amount of time. Just the idea that like I would go to Death & Company and see like, you know, 400 drinks or whatever in the menu. And I would just kind of like naively be like, how do you memorize all these? How did you make all these up? But then I was like, no, there's like five formats or six formats.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, pattern recognition,
right?
And I love that. Love that. And like so that's kind of one big thing, is like my liquor cabinet expanded quite a bit. It's both educational and functional in times of stress and COVID. Yep. I have to admit, but yeah, that's probably the biggest thing that I've I've kind of acquired. But yeah, specifically the I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, the punti mess that I add into my Negronis and Boulevardiers is my preferred ingredient, and that's my go-to vermouth that I love. So that's my new thing.
Awesome. Well, I mean, on that recommendation, I'll have to go pick some up. It's not something that appears much in my home. I don't have any Puntevas in my home bar, but Negronis and Boulevardiers definitely appear. So I'll have to I'll take that recommendation. What's coming up in the future for Alpha Food Labs? Do you have any interesting projects coming up?
We do, actually. We feel very fortunate because despite all that's going on in the world, we've been really busy at work, and we've been working on some really interesting projects. One that we're kind of halfway through right now is we've been working with the country of New Zealand on helping them to understand the state of regenerative agriculture on a global scale. Mm. So that has been really awesome because in New Zealand, farming and ranching is so progressive in so many ways. You know, I think, like, you take one example, looking at the state of grass-fed over there. Well, like, grass-fed pasture-raised beef is default there. You know, they don't have any feedlots. And, you know, in America, it's the inverse, right? And so they're very progressive in that ways. And so they've always kind of been really agile and kind of looking at kind of emerging conversations and kind of exploring. And, you know, regenerative agriculture is interesting because while the techniques that surround it have been around for millennia, cover cropping, making sure your soil's healthy, all that good stuff, the conversation about it has kind of been trending in the food world for a while now, and it's kind of gaining steam. So it's been really fascinating because through this project and for them, we've been able to kind of understand in a bunch of different countries, what's the state of regenerative agriculture right now? What are the roadblocks that are hindering progress from it? What are the opportunities that are out there for people to kind of do better with agriculture? And then we'll be embarking on kind of starting to talk to some regular old consumers to try to explain to them what regenerative agriculture is, because it's a very complex topic. And so it's hard to distill that down to something that someone can just, like, stand there at the grocery store shelf and say, like, oh, I get it. but we're going to try. And I think that's kind of an exciting phase of the project for us. So, yeah, that's been a very rewarding and very interesting project getting to work with those guys there.
Awesome. What do you think about Tom Vilsack coming back to the Department of Agriculture?
Yeah. geez. You know, I don't know. Part of me is kind of like, I think he's better than some other alternatives, but part of me is like, there's such a slow logjam of, like, conversation around, like, ag, unfortunately. Yeah. Like, it's just so... I want to be optimistic and say that we can, like, kind of have one person kind of cure it all, but I think there's an endemic cultural, like, shift that needs to happen, you know? Food doesn't ever come up in any of these debates. Like, I don't think we heard about food. I think Beto O'Rourke said regenerative agriculture in the primaries, and that was the last time I think we heard about food in the whole election. So, I don't know. Part of, you know, I'm not a policy guy, but, like, part of me is, like, I don't think policy is the linchpin to kind of curing the food system, but I think there's a lot it can do to kind of not get in its way and reset incentives. I think that's kind of the thing. So,
yeah, I mean, I kind of wish, you know, I mean, I knew, right, that the Biden administration was not going to be as, like, progressive and earth-shattering as I kind of wanted it to be. It would have been great if it was. I mean, I kind of really like the Mother Jones headline, which is Biden picks stale white bread to lead the USDA.
There you go. There you go.
I mean, it's like, fine. You know, I think he was fine. I think he, I mean, he did more, you know, I think he did some good stuff, and I don't think he's going to, you know, I don't think he's going to dial things back in a horrible way, but I don't feel like, you know, we're not looking at, like, incredible change, I don't think.
Well, and that kind of brings me to the bigger thought that I have, which is, like, does the system even allow for bigger change in that? Like, you know, assume you had the most inspirational progressive person you could ever imagine in that position. There's so much friction working against that person. Like, you know, Like if you like made a mutant of like Joel Salatin and Dan Barber and like, you know, Michael Pollan and made that the USA secretary, how much could you actually change? Because that's a giant machine.
Yeah.
It's a huge machine with so many kind of entrenched interests. There's so many people that profit from the way it's working right now that that is a huge amount of gravity to escape from. Yeah. And that's sort of a cynical fact, but it's, I think, the truth. So that's why, like, I think, you know, when you hear about Vilsack or Fudge or whoever, I'm kind of like, yeah, that's not bad, but like, I don't really know where they can take it, you know? Right. And that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess on the bright side, it sounds like the work that you're doing in places like New Zealand, you know, it are really good, and it sounds like you know, we have to remember. I mean, I feel like it's very easy, especially now that we're all stuck at home, even though we have access to this giant thing called the internet, like, you know, the world is not America. And you know,
yeah.
and there are good things to that and bad things to that. But like, you know, all of that is to say that, like, you know, we're still only one part of the world and of the world economy. And so, you know, I think it's worth looking for bright spots outside of the United States as well.
Well, New Zealand's been really interesting too, because I think, you know, if you think something's hard to do on a policy standpoint in the United States, I'm not saying we're doing any of this, but like there's the potential in New Zealand to like maybe do something faster, right?
Mm.
We saw how incredibly efficient and fast Jacinda Ardern and her government squashed coronavirus.
Right.
Like, oh my Lord, you know, I remember after the Christchurch shootings, like, they got rid of assault rifles in like 31 days or something like that, right?
Yep.
Like, they are like, we're the tortoise, they're the hare.
Yeah.
Except I don't know if we'll get over the finish line eventually. So they're just like, yeah, I'm done. So, you know, that's interesting to me is like, you know, my dream of dreams would to be like all these aspirations we have, maybe on a policy level. How do we find places, and maybe it's New Zealand, maybe it's other places. How do we find places outside of the US where there's a more, call it efficient kind of infrastructure to kind of prove these things out, you know?
Yep.
Because some things, like, people have fear of the unknown, and until you kind of demonstrate what that thing is, people don't want to take the effort to remove, like, the existing infrastructure. So what if we could set up this little, like, test case of something like regenerative agriculture in other countries? And then we could point to that at least and say, like, here's what happens. I think that could be great in accelerating the countries that have a more fraught kind of political landscape, like, you know, the United States.
Yeah. Well, Mike, it has been awesome, as always, to talk with you today for Feast Your Ears.
Thank you.
Where can people find out more and follow you and Alpha Food Labs and all that stuff?
Yeah, Alpha Food Labs at alphafoodlabs.com is our website. And then you can check out some of those weird Instagrams at my Instagram, which is Mike Lee, L-E-E, all one word.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. Congratulations about Aria. You know, hope to see you in person for some live fire cooking in 2021.
You as well. Thanks, Harry.
Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can follow Mike Lee at Mike Lee on Instagram and learn more about his other work at alphafoodlabs.com. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please reach out if you have any questions. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. And I just want to say sayonara to 2020, and I'll talk to you in 2021. Have a great holiday season and a happy new year. Feast Your Ears is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter, @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.